With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to be looking again at Ring of Steel by Alexander Watson. We're going to be looking at the social makeup of Germany in 1914 and what bearing that has on Germany's war and the relative social kind of cohesion that existed. Germany goes into the war relatively socially united. Perhaps this is something similar for many countries in Europe, but in Germany, it's pivotal for the first 2 years. And then that social compact begins to fragment. Now, before we get into this, I have some pretty good news. A while back, I was making an effort to try not to buy things from places like Amazon and to pick out a independent bookshop that needed, you know, some business. And so I came across Storytellers in St. Anne's, which is St. Anne's is nowhere near me. I'm here in Wales. But I chose to give them my business, and I have encouraged people to do the same. You know, just find an indie bookshop somewhere and embrace it, and, you know, look after it, be a good patron of it. So I'm going to do my review of the year in a couple of weeks' time, the best books I've read this year. And I'm just going to encourage everybody, if they are going to buy any of these books, to go to Storytellers and to put your business there, because you'll help a little gem of a bookshop. So in response, Storytellers have said that anybody who listens to the podcast and contacts them quoting Explaining History, the term Explaining History, will be able to order anything I'm recommending at a 10% discount. So, you know, make sure that you do. And they're a great little bookshop. And if you don't even use them, if you are buying anything for Christmas, go to a local retailer, pay a couple of pounds more, and it will be worth it. It will be worth it, because we've got to protect these guys. Okay, now into the history. So Germany had been riven by class conflict in the decade running up to the First World War. And the Kaiser was very mindful, as were his chancellors during that decade, very mindful that something needed to be done, and perhaps even war was the answer. Though I've always shied away from the thesis that was probably put around in the 1980s, that the Kaiser was motivated to go to war in order to distract from Germany's social problems. I'm not convinced by that one at all. So, Alexander Watson writes, "The German people entered the First World War remarkably united. Differences of class and confession, religion and race, seemed to many who lived through these times suddenly to melt away in the national emergency. The Russian general mobilisation decisively shifted popular opinion, turning war from an unthinkable horror into a defensive necessity." This is the key to understanding why German society rapidly united in 1914. It was the threat, not of the French particularly, but of the Russians marching on Germany. The SDP, the SPD, beg your pardon, the SPD, the Socialist Party, the largest party in Germany at the time, voted for the war, voted for the Kaiser's war budget. Basically, on this basis alone, they said that, you know, you won't get socialism by having the Tsar's soldiers ransacking Berlin. If that happens, and the Russians sweep across Europe, that'll be the last chance for anything remotely progressive in Germany to occur. So getting behind the Kaiser's war effort is a good idea. So Alexander Watson writes, "The fear at the outbreak of hostilities was important in promoting readiness to suspend domestic quarrels and seek safety and solidarity. The Reich government also acted skillfully, however, in building consensus and cultivating unity. The distrust between Germany's conservative authorities and its largest political party, the Social Democrats, should not be underestimated. On the 30th of July, after German mobilisation was mistakenly reported in the Berliner local Anzeiger, Friedrich Ebert, one of the party's two chairmen, and Otto Bauer, its treasurer, fled with the party's finances to safety in Switzerland. As late as the 31st of July, its leaders reckoned that if war broke out, they would be arrested. It was thus little short of astounding and of immense importance for Germany's war effort that less than a week later, the party would vote unanimously for war credits." And its other chairman, Hugo Haas, announced to the Reichstag that in the hour of danger, we do not leave the fatherland in the lurch. Lenin had an immense amount to say about this, all of it critical. He was hugely, in some ways, disappointed in and angry at Europe's socialist parties, but then essentially said, well, what do you expect? These really are kind of sleeper agents for capitalism. And it defined ever more clearly the argument of revolutionary socialists across Europe, that democratic socialists were really just capitalists in disguise who were more than happy to sacrifice the working class in the interests of fighting a capitalist war. But they were in some ways slightly more slippery characters than the forces of reaction themselves, and portrayed themselves as being far more progressive than they actually were. The government, and above all Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, had worked hard to make this possible, writes Alexander Watson. From the start of the crisis, it had shown respect for the Social Democrats. On the 26th of July, Haas had been called to the Prussian Interior Ministry and told that the SPD's anti-war protests would not be suppressed. An invitation from the Chancellor had followed 3 days later, but neither Haas nor the SPD leaders in Berlin were in Berlin. Another socialist, Albert Sudikam, attended. Bethmann stressed to him the peaceful intentions of the Kaiser's government and was assured by Sudikam that the party had no intention of initiating strikes or sabotage. The Chancellor reported to the following day to the Prussian Ministry of State that there was nothing particular to fear from the SPD. The government was also sufficiently confident of the Socialist Union's patriotism once war broke out that on the 2nd of August, their leader Karl Liegen was informed that there was no intention to repress his organisation. So there are some interesting questions to raise here. The extent to which the German left really embraced the kind of internationalism that people like the Bolsheviks professed to embrace, the extent to which the root beneath the rhetoric of the democratic left in Germany, a kind of a degree of patriotism and nationalism was prevalent amongst German workers, their representatives, and the leaders of Germany's working class organisations and political parties. And I think it's difficult to separate Germany's and perhaps probably anywhere else the democratic socialist tradition and patriotism and a sense of shared unity in a time of national crisis, particularly when you look at the geographical position of Germany, a sense of being surrounded by potential enemies and under siege. I mean, the title of the book, Ring of Steel, was a term that the German politicians and military leaders had for the alliances that surrounded Germany, that essentially Germany, that Britain, France and Russia had created a ring of steel around the country. So there is this fear of living under conditions of siege, and that has to shape mentalities when war begins and there are all of a sudden higher national priorities than workers' interests and these kind of sectional sort of feuds that between labour and capital over national resources over the shares of profit. The Prussian military, belying its reputation as a reactionary and politically unsavvy organisation, also played its part. This was crucially important. Once the state of siege was declared on the late afternoon of the 31st of July, wide-ranging powers had passed under the provisions of Prussia's 1851 law on the state of siege to the generals who headed the 24 army corps districts that covered the Reich. They, or once they had mobilised their units and left for the battlefield, their deputies were responsible for the maintenance of public security during the emergency. They could suspend constitutional rights and had the authority to issue orders to civilian administrations within their core districts. The army's view in peacetime, based on the studies of insurgencies, had been that early and decisive action was the key to maintaining internal order in a crisis. Yet the soldiers also understood that repressing organisations which possessed the loyalty not only of many reservists, but also of the railway workers essential for a successful mobilisation, would be both risky and damaging for national morale. As early as the 25th of July, the discussion with the civilian government, the Prussian War Minister General Erich von Falkenhayn, issued Army Corps District Generals with guidelines recommending vigilance, but warning against overly hasty or strict action. It is not desirable, the generals were admonished, for political parties through suppression of their press and arrest of their leaders to be pushed from the beginning into sharp opposition to the government. So, there's an awful lot to unpack there. What we can see is that the militarised nature of Germany was a much more militarised society than probably any other society in Europe. And the amount of kind of military administration of civilian Germany meant that, firstly, there was little chance before the final kind of crisis in 1918. Of the country spiralling out of control in a way that Russia did, but also that the generals at home had an immense amount of power and an immense amount of license to censor and to manage relations with civilian Germany, to shut down organisations and to make on-the-spot decisions about what law and order should look like during wartime. This perhaps gives us clues as to why it is by the last 2 years of the war Hindenburg and Ludendorff are effectively running the country as dictators. And that militarisation also continues after the war. The kind of the authoritarian power of the army in the in civilian Germany. It's interesting when you look at Hitler's immediate post-war employment as essentially a spy working for the army of Bavaria. And spending time visiting small political parties in Munich to assess their kind of revolutionary potential and whether they're a danger and whether they need to be shut down and their members arrested or what have you. It's not the Bavarian state that has employed him. It is the army of Bavaria that is acting as its own entity. Giving him orders and instructions, which he's obviously more than happy to follow. So militarism before the war, during and afterwards, is deeply woven into the fabric of German society. And during the war, on the home front, army officers have a higher prestige and a greater degree of power than in probably any other European country. As with the previous example about Falkenhayn and the SPD, where Falkenhayn gave the SPD plenty of reassurances, as he did the trade unions, and was also reassured in return that these people wouldn't be troublemakers and didn't need any trouble to be made for them. There was no need to cause additional strife by cracking down on fairly compliant parties of the centre-left. It's clear here that the official guidance towards military governors across Germany is, you know, don't go breaking skulls where none need to be broken. You know, be vigilant towards dissent and troublemakers, but by and large, don't go acting like petty tyrants and creating trouble for yourselves and for the army where none needs to exist. The Army Corps district's generals could be given orders only by the Kaiser. Yet although under no obligation, they did follow the War Minister's guidelines towards the Social Democrats and unions. Interestingly, however, writes Alexander Watson, this was less true of the treatment of the other major suspect groups in Germany, its minorities. Even in 1914, race posed a greater barrier than class to entry into the national community. In West Prussia and Upper Silesia, Polish language newspapers were temporarily banned, although admittedly so was the SPD press. Many Poles, including some minor community leaders, were arrested. So great was suspicion that there were even searches of Catholic churches for weapons or for the entrances to tunnels leading to Russia. Local military commanders were responsible for these actions. Disgruntled provincial civil authorities, who generally had not been consulted, later pointed out that the arrests did not result in even a single prosecution. Unsurprisingly, the measures were demoralising for a community that was overwhelmingly obedient in August 1914. They signalled clearly, as one disgruntled Polish speaker noted in his diary, "You are the enemy." Now, one of the things we looked at in a previous podcast, also based on this book, was the wave of anti-Slavic racist hysteria that happened in the summer of 1914 following the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. You have, across the Austro-Hungarian Empire, panic and paranoia about Slav people in the Balkans, in the Crown lands, or what are Bohemia and Moravia, or Czechoslovakia now, and in the Austrian and German parts of what is now Poland. And there was a kind of a wave of attacks upon Slavic people in German occupied Europe, or Germanic Europe, or German dominated Europe. So it's hardly any surprise that you have a repression of Polish newspapers and Polish culture briefly at the beginning of the First World War. But also, as it points out, the majority of Poles that came under German rule were entirely loyal to the Germans and were entirely happy to be ruled by, or to at least acquiesce to Germany's war effort. For many, the prospect of the Tsar's armies marching across Silesia and into Prussia was an unattractive one, and Poles had many, many long and bitter memories about their treatment at the hands of the Russians. And so it was very much a kind of a devil you know sort of situation.
In West Germany, in the west of Germany, Alsace-Lorrainers were treated even more harshly. Civil-military relations in this area had been poisonous before the war, and the army, which suspected the population of French sympathies, did not hesitate to take around 400 people into custody, including 19 clergymen and two deputies from the regional parliament. As with the Polish minority, the soldiers were unfamiliar with local conditions and, relying on denunciations, ended up unjustly detaining many loyal subjects. These peoples lived on enemy frontiers, which goes some way to explain the nervousness and repression. This was not true of Germany's Danish minority, however, whose press was closed and its leaders arrested. Some 172 people associated with the Danish national movement, including Reichstag deputy Hans Peter Hansen, were imprisoned. A further 118 German Danes were deprived of their freedom solely because of their knowledge of the coastal waters. It was feared they might help men not wishing to be drafted flee across the Danish border or even assist a British naval attack. Of course, the other anxiety about somewhere like Denmark or the Danish minority in Germany, or even the Germano-French minority in Alsace-Lorraine, was that during the war, separatist movements might have ample opportunity to break away from Germany. And this was something that was considered to be a real clear and present threat to the unity of a state that had only existed since 1871. So arresting nationalist leaders and arresting nationalist politicians and nationalist journalists in 1914 probably seemed like a good preemptive measure. The Kaiser wanted to see in 1914 a new Germany emerge, a Germany without class distinctions, without party rivalries, without nationalist ethnic divides. And of course the Kaiser was an intellectually weak and inattentive man who lived in fantasy for much of his life and simply assumed that because this was desirable to him, it would be achievable, and assumed, as several people in the First World War, you know, the likes of the Italian journalist at the time, Mussolini, believed that war would forge national unity and national identity, and it would make national citizens out of people who were simply the inhabitants of nation states, and the Kaiser articulates this in 1914 and hopes that this will come to pass. And we're going to look more at that in a separate podcast and look more closely at the Kaiser's wishes in that regard. But I'll leave you now on this thought. This sentiment, this kind of brief sense of unity, lasts for 2 years, and when it fragments and falls apart, Germany faces ruination and crisis, and the German war ends, of course, with a social revolution in 1918. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.